So how do you handle it when your institution has a troublemaker? Well, what if the troublemaker's right and you're wrong? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Of course, in the real world, it's never all that clear-cut. But still, are there ways an institution seeking to reform can tolerate, to learn to tolerate, and benefit from dissent? Our number toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. Email talk at aprn.org. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We are asking the Muckraker of the Year to imagine a situation where muckrakers are no longer needed on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
So the Muckraker's Ball is coming around again. It's put on by Cook Inlet Keeper. It's basically a fundraiser. They have a ball, though. I mean, they have a ball. It's a party. And one of the things they decided to do with the Muckraker's Ball is to give the Muckraker of the Year award out. And they've gone to interesting people. Ray Metcalf got one. Jeannie Devon, the Alaska Mudflats, got one. And let's see, who else? Ricky Ott. I think Ricky Ott got one. And one of Ricky Ott's cronies got one this year. And that is Rick Steiner, former professor at the University of Alaska. Rick Steiner, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks very much, Steve. Good to be here.
Now, before we even get started here, I mean, we already know the subject is going to be like dissent, corporate responsibility, institutions, and how they can they adapt and like that. But your situation with the university, basically, after you resigned at the university, and the way I've been putting it is that you were harassed out of the university, which I don't know, they wouldn't agree with that, but looks
well,
like that to me.
Yeah, that's basically what happened, yeah.
So I remember, oddly, you said, well, I'm not interested in making a case out of this. And I'm wondering now if, is that, I mean, you did go to Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. As far as I know, they're still interested in this, and they still think of it as a case. Is it still alive as a case? Because I think it'll influence how we progress on this show.
Well, where it's live, basically I resigned from the university in protest because they terminated my federal NOAA funding because of public statements I made, which were critical of the risks of offshore oil and gas development in Bristol Bay. They didn't like that. The university gets a lot of money from oil and gas, both directly and indirectly through the state budget. And so they were basically pandering to their political and financial benefactors by, shutting me down. So I resigned. I fought it as much as I could and then gave up. Where it's still alive is for all the faculty and students that are still in the university. What's important is the cloud that this incident leaves over the existing University of Alaska. If people can't speak up without fear of reprisal, then you don't really have a university. You have a consulting firm that offers degrees. The other place that my case, excuse me, happens to be live is Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility filed a petition for rulemaking at NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to seek them to remove the gag order that they essentially place on their grants to university faculty. So that will be, hopefully, they said they'd have a decision by last April, but then Deepwater Horizon occurred, and so things have slowed down, but we'll see.
Well, that was a big thing for you, the Deepwater Horizon. Essentially, you ended up going down to the Gulf of Mexico, and I think you already had an international reputation. But it grew substantially, wouldn't you say?
Well, there was a lot of media exposure. But, I mean, the thing is these incidents continue to occur. And this gets us to the critical role of dissent, both within the corporate world and within government. We raised the flag of the real risks of a blowout like this in a place like Bristol Bay, causing undue damage, an enormous amount of damage to a sustainable industry there, salmon fishing, and other endangered species and such. And finally, the federal government came around and agreed with us, with a number of people raising this issue, and pulled the Bristol Bay lease sale off the five-year plan. Right. That was an appropriate, good decision. Then Deepwater Horizon went. And, I've worked on these things all over the world, and generally you find that people have raised the flag saying there is a risk here. But then you find companies and governments being dismissive, if not outright hostile towards that sort of dissent. And so that gets us to the issue that companies and government agencies need to be more inclusive of dissenting different opinions.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, it's one of these undeniable realities. This blowout happened.
Yeah.
And there's been enough investigation at this point that we can get some idea of why and how it happened.
Right.
And we can see that regulation was insufficient, let's put it that way. And that was acknowledged immediately by the Obama administration. And suddenly the Minerals Management Service became the BOEMRE, which some is calling bummer now.
Yeah, that's right. It's a close
but that effort. Doesn't necessarily, and there's a, there was a change at the top.
Well,
but
you
that
know,
doesn't take any of the middle management out and doesn't necessarily change the corporate culture.
And this is a perfect example of
yes.
where dissent is important. 2 years prior to the Deepwater Horizon explosion, we had people coming to us from the agency saying there's a real problem in how the agency is making decisions, and dissenters were marginalized and many left the agency. We brought this up to the transition team of the Obama administration, that you have a serious problem in this agency, Minerals Management Service. It needs to be either disbanded or seriously restructured. They did nothing. And therefore, the Obama administration certainly has complicity in the Deepwater Horizon disaster, simply because they people within their agencies were telling them there is a risk here. This agency isn't capable of doing the job. You need to listen to these people. They didn't. That gets us also back to the absolute essential component of dissent.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, politically, probably it's sort of a tap dance going on by the administration, because they're very nervous about domestic energy production, and there may be the best intentions in the world, but the political doability might give them pause. So to be nice to them.
Yeah, yeah. And where the real true progressive managers of companies, and I think Dick will talk to this to some extent as well, of companies and government agencies, are those that invite dissenting opinions and alternative viewpoints, incorporate them into their decision-making process. And what we've found, and people have found this all over the world, is that makes a more robust, generally more accurate and progressive and solid policy decision. And so those companies that are starting to invite that into how they decide, that brings us as well to Alaska. There's a lot of people here in agencies and in the oil industry, for instance, and the fishing industry, that see things that are going wrong or that could be done better. And if they don't have a progressive way, a conduit to make those views known, then what happens is this thing called groupthink, also called mob psychology, where a group can form consensus around a very bad idea, even not knowing that they're forming consensus around a bad idea. And then, you know, we have countless examples of this in the financial, implosion over the last couple of years. In the invasion of Iraq, there were people in the State Department and the intelligence community bringing up the issue that, is this the right thing to do? And, oh, by the way, we don't think there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. If those dissenting viewpoints had been incorporated into the policy decision, hopefully we would have made a more appropriate decision.
Well, it would seem that the opportunity is there. I mean, we're having all this investigation at Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah.
We had, BP already was in big trouble.
They were on probation here in Alaska.
Because of their Alaska stuff and because of the big refinery blow up. So we're clearly seeing efforts to change the corporate culture there. We've seen a sort of amazing change at Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, where suddenly the Coast Guard admiral that was in charge of regulating them to some degree is now in charge of the corporation. So I think there's intent and opportunity if we can actually get to the nuts and bolts of how we actually do it. And to that, I turn to Dick Lefever, management consultant. The ball's in your court, Mr. Lefever. You're with the Crossroads Leadership Institute, and you basically do consulting, and you're doing some teaching too. And you try and consult corporations and institutions for leadership. And I would think being able to constructively accept dissent.
Well, that's absolutely right, Steve. And I listened in, very intently what Rick was just sharing and catching up on some of the things that he's doing and has been involved in. And it's interesting. You go back and even take a look at the Challenger disaster and you look at Morton Thiokol, and there were people inside that organization. That's a whole O-ring kind of thing that happened. And they actually were pressured not only by NASA, but also from their own higher-ups. Scientists knew that if they tried to go with a launch with the temperature the way it was, that there was a high probability of failure. And, of course, we all know what happened. All of the astronauts died, including Christy McAuliffe, who was the first teacher to go into space. And that was...
I was, by the way, trying to be one of the first journalists in space right at the same time. I remember Channel 2 came around and said, was you...
There's still time, Steve.
Would you react to this for us? I said, well, actually, management wouldn't let me.
Well, I'll share...
But anyway, it blew all my chance, for sure.
Well, it's... I could go on some stories about who we should send into space and maybe have them come back.
Jake Garn got him instead.
But it is. Actually, I want to use something that my business partner, Terry Stimson, actually brought back from Harvard. After Terry served in the state Senate in the late 70s, early 80s, and became disillusioned with the public process and the legislative process, and we've been business partners for almost, 20 years, actually. And Terry left the legislature and went back to Harvard and got his PhD there with the Fielding Institute, which I also attended. And he studied with a man named Chris Argus. And Chris Argus had these elements of dialogue. And I wanted to share one that fits in very appropriately here right now. And it's number 6 of this list of 7, and it says, encourage and welcome disconfirming information.
Here, here.
Now, that is very difficult for managers, CEOs, any of us. I mean, it's the old oxymoron of constructive criticism, right? I mean, who wants to be criticized? But I also take, I've been a real fan of Robert Greenleaf, who was really an advocate, and then later Peter Block, of this concept of servant leadership. If we turn the pyramid, the traditional organizational pyramid, upside down, instead of it running downhill, as we like to say, you see the CEO or the chief executive at the bottom of that pyramid, whose job and responsibility is to deliver the goods and services, the product, if you will, to the customers, to the public, in a way that really serves people. Now, that's not just altruistic. It's good business. And I think we're finding... businesses that can take this kind of attitude are in the long run going to survive and thrive, because people are not going to put up with this kind of nonsense that's going on. My wife and I just went to see Fair Game, and of course, you know, it's a Hollywood movie. But everything that I can read, and I'm just finishing Andrew Bajewicz's book on Washington Rules, and this whole idea of perpetual war and the cover-ups and, you know, the CYA and, you know, all of, see, you know, cover your rear end, right, kind of thing, and the shenanigans that we see going on. I mean, it's so pervasive. Getting ready for this program, I went and researched whistleblowers in Alaska, whistleblowers in the lower 48. I teach business ethics at APU, and I have students actually go out and interview people that they feel have a high set of moral values and high business ethics. And they also take a look at cases in Alaska where there has been ethical lapses, whistleblowers, even Mr. Steiner here has been focused on and researched from newspaper articles and such. So I think there is a curve, if you will, that's sort of going up, and we're demanding more accountability. Business schools, there's been recent research on MBA programs where MBA students in many of these programs have been found cheating. So there's a culture of cutting corners, of, groupthink that Rick talked about. If somebody else is doing it, we can do it. It's easy to get into. It's seductive. And it's one of the big challenges that I find going into an organization is getting managers, executives, boards even, to really be open to this disconfirming feedback.
You know, you're almost talking about old-fashioned morality in a certain sense. And what we've explored on this program a few times when it comes to corporate responsibility and investment and sustainability is you might not stay in business if you're a nice guy. You know, so we have this economic matrix of competition, and competition delivers benefits at the lower prices, products that they won't survive, they don't survive the test in the marketplace, various things like this. And it would seem that structurally this operates against the type of management that you're advocating. If you're too nice a guy, you're going to get wiped out by the competition.
Well, I think it comes across not as being nice, but being, when I say good business, you're looking at doing business in a way that is both eco-friendly, that is empowering employees, not having a high rate of turnover, being an employer of choice, having a reputation in the marketplace for good products, good services. There was a study done a number of years ago of companies that applied the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award principles. This is the highest quality award that's given in the country. And there are six or seven areas that are focused on. Two of the highest happen to deal with customer satisfaction and business results. And companies that score high in these two areas have outperformed on the stock market other companies that do not embrace these kinds of concepts. So it is doable. And companies that do embark on this can be successful.
Let me just ask you this, Dick Lefevre. You do a lot of consulting. You were telling me you got a map full of pins of places where you've done management consulting. What percentage of them are ready to accept, let's say, the Baldrige principles? What percentage of them are actually ready to make a constructive move? I mean, granted that there probably are some areas of overlap between being a nice guy and also having a sustainable business. There's areas of overlap. How often can you get an outfit to concentrate on that?
Well, I think it's increasing, Steve, and there's organizations here in town that are actually doing it. There's national companies represented here that have actually won the Baldrige, Motorola, FedEx, UPS. There's different companies. GE's represented here in some ways. But there's companies here in Alaska that have applied for the Baldrige. The Chugach School District, for example, was the first school district in the U.S. to win the Baldrige. Little tiny school district. Other school districts have aspirations. Hospitals, healthcare organizations, not just the Baldrige, but they're looking at lean management techniques, looking at different continuous improvement methodologies, and really looking at how they can turn a product, reduce waste, increase profitability through these strategies. More and more are. There's a great more sophistication on the part of a lot of the managers and CEOs today, either because they've gone off to a conference or I think the consulting group. There are a lot of good consultants here in Alaska, a lot of good consultants that have this background. The awareness is there. A lot of these efforts are being made, and a lot of companies are applying right now to the Baldrige.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned some private sector as well as nonprofits and institutions in there, because I think the institutions would, in some cases, be a little bit easier target because they might not have that competitive pressure of the marketplace. Rick, I wanted to ask you to chime in on this one.
Sure. You know, I think your issue of that it's competitive to be ruthless and mean-spirited and such, I think that's kind of the old model, actually. And those companies...
Well, I mean, we had this incredible thing that happened to our financial services industry.
Well, and there
we
were...
We haven't assimilated it very well even now.
No.
But essentially, I remember having Catherine Austin Fitz on this program from the Bioneers like mm-hmm. 3 years ago, and she said... They're pumping and dumping our whole economy. We're not going to be left with anything productive, really.
Right, and those are the sorts of points of view.
Well, nobody would listen. She was dissenting marginalized and whatnot, but she was absolutely dead on. We still haven't faced that.
Right. There were people like Mabel Yu who operated and worked for an investment firm, and she knew that the investments that everybody else was making were making were bogus, and she basically saved her firm tens of millions of dollars by not going down that route. The people at Enron called questions about the company. So there's more to say about this, too.
Well, go ahead.
Well, essentially, there's been this perpetual dynamic between conformity and dissent. And this goes back to our evolutionary development, actually. A solitary primate was generally a dead primate back, 2 million years ago and 200,000 years ago. So there was this great urge for conformity, obedience, and loyalty to group. However, there's some evolutionary geneticists and such and ecologists saying that, well, it was those dissenters, those mavericks, those individuals from the primate troop that actually explored and looked for new habitat and such like that. They may have been selected against because it was a high-risk venture. However, they were also the ones that helped the group progress. And so I think that same dynamic is existing today, where there's a need for both conformity, loyalty, and obedience on the one hand, and for dissent and innovative, creative thinking on the other. And those companies that understand that are right. The ones that are going to progress.
What do you think about Dick's notion of the inverted pyramid with the boss being the servant?
Well, essentially, the whole old structural model of corporations is being rethought. And I think that's a good thing. And for government agencies and universities as well. I mean, if there's any institution in civil society that ought to understand this, it should be a university. However, here in Alaska, it is certainly not. And so that's a problem.
I don't know. To me, there's so little accountability in universities. It's almost a denial factory.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see much future really for your...
Well, and to be fair, there are some very good people in the University of Alaska. There's also some very uninspiring people, and particularly on the administration side. So let's set that one aside. But the notion of how to restructure civil society, we are on the brink of environmental and social breakdown globally. So those institutions that got us here are not going to be the ones to get us out. I think that's a paraphrase of Albert Einstein.
Dick, you sound like you agree with that.
Well, I absolutely agree with what Rick's saying. Those old paradigms die hard, and I think we're seeing a resurgence right now of some of the old thinking in terms of our national politics.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate because I think people are grasping at this dying beast and wanting to resurrect it in some ways that gives them comfort that that's the way it was, that the way it used to be. You think about just the transformation of religion and the dissenters. You could look at Martin Luther. You look at the people that migrated to this country. And I was telling Steve earlier, I'm actually Native American. I was born and raised on a reservation in Montana, so it has a special meaning for me. But you take a look at they dissented. I remember when the American Indian movement got started. I was back on the reservation. Our tribe was taking over a former BIA school. We were dissenting against the federal government. One of our tribal council members, Ted Risingson, mobilized people. We actually petitioned the solicitor's office, the Department of Interior, and took over a school. And the American Indian movement came through on their way to Dakotas, which ended up ultimately at Wounded Knee, and they were going to take over the school, and they found out that we'd already taken it over, so they moved on.
I'm really glad you brought up that precedent, because that's a part of the civil rights movement that doesn't usually get augmented as it should with that whole social and cultural movement. But that was very, very inspirational.
AIM provided some of the methods sometimes people, especially there was kind of a rift between reservation natives and some of the AIM members, and there was generational kinds of things. I was telling Steve, I wrote my master's thesis on this whole idea of sort of the institutional Indian, and when the BIA started putting natives into BIA positions, it didn't change except the color of the person behind the desk, the policies.
Same culture,
the same behavior, just stayed the same.
And that's his master's thesis. Yeah.
But AIM really provided that stimulus. It was like the Black Panthers or other dissident groups. It provided that real shock to the system that said, take a look at this, folks.
Yeah, but you get too much shock, and then you're in the shock doctrine land, and all of a sudden everybody wants to go to get behind their security blanket, and that may be where we are right now, especially after 9/11. Yeah. You know, I remember growing up in the 50s. By the time the late 50s arrived, Organization Man and all these things had come along that were starting to criticize the established order, and by the time I was late in high school, I knew I didn't want to be a conformist because that's what it was called. You had those who conform, and then you had the non-conformists, you know, which were a small minority. I don't want to go back to those years of that extremely confined social situation that you see in Father's Knows Best, and you see in these, you know, you laugh at them when you see how could people have actually been serious about living that way. Well, believe me, I was there. We did live that way, and everybody was supposed to live that way. And it was only when you started breaking out of that, you know, I don't want to lose those benefits.
No,
you know, that's why I'm doing this program. I want to see how we can actually keep that kernel of dissent alive.
Well, there's a noble tradition in dissent throughout civil society, and a lot of it began in 1787 when about 12 people got around a table in a print shop in London and started conceiving ways to abolish the slave trade. And then it took 50 or 60 years for that to become illegal globally, you know, mid-1800s in the U.S., but then since then, of course, you had, you know, Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, and the civil rights movement. Mahatma Gandhi, you know, was a great leader. He actually borrowed a lot of his ideas from Thoreau and Emerson from a century before on civil disobedience.
Yeah. So I'm so glad you're bringing this up in this historical way, the same way I was astonished to visit the National Park at Harper's Ferry and see that W.E.B. Du Bois had chosen there to try and start his ACLU. He didn't. And the reason was because they wouldn't let him. You know, he ended up having to do it up in Canada. But still, to go to Harper's Ferry, and what was Harper's Ferry? That's where John Brown, who none of us would condone, but he had the fire to carry that abolitionist vision across the continent.
And there are still people to this day, lots of people. There's one of the greatest movements in civil society history is going on right now, and this is 1 million to perhaps 2 million non-governmental civic organizations throughout the world that are forming a sort of a non-coalesced movement for social justice and environmental rights throughout the world. They have no leader, no name for the movement. But Paul Hawken has written a great book called Blessed Unrest about this and talks about the notion that this is the way. This is the bottom-up pyramid that Dick was talking about.
Really?
Yes. This is people organically forming these ideas and putting them forward without regard for consequence and without regard for convention and making their views known. And this is going on right here. We're part of it right here today on your show. And you, by the way, you do a great job on these shows in general by bringing these issues forward. But this movement is really growing globally, even by people who don't recognize they're part of it.
Yeah, and that brings up this idea of self-organizing systems. And I know as a biologist, I'm assuming you're a biologist, Rick, in training and background for sure. That civil, the kind of group that these NGOs that Rick just talked about is a self-organizing system that's taking a look at what can we do in promoting the voices that they're supporting and putting forth. And I think we have to encourage that in our organizations. I think enlightened CEOs need to tap into the resources, the number one resource they have. We always hear it, the human resource, but not just, you don't hire hands, you hire a mind as well. And you need to tap into that rich resource. And sometimes that means listening to people that may not agree with the policies, and you need to cultivate that. There are constructive ways of bringing forth that disconfirming information, and that's a valuable, valuable set of feedback that you can get.
It seems like we just don't, we haven't developed the protocols, I guess. And I'm going to think about that while we take a break.
It certainly takes secure managers, people that are not insecure and deathly afraid. And
good point.
You know, and so that's what it takes. And those that can step up to inviting dissenting opinions are those managers of the future.
And we'll be back to this as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about corporate responsibility, institutional responsibility, tolerance of dissent within any kind of institution. Pam in Anchorage, you'll be the next caller, but first I want to get this from Adam, who says, say hi to my friend Rick. I recently finished a business degree. Ethics and progressive thinking were not a focus.
Hi, Adam.
What is taught is that groups of people make better decisions than individuals, and diverse groups make the best decisions. I know that when I am managing a project or an organization, I want people who don't agree with me involved. The most dangerous thing for an organization is to delude yourself into thinking you completely understand everything. And if you don't have a dissenter involved in your decision-making process, you probably are not getting all the data you need. Locking the dissenters out of the room is the surest way to eventually fail, often quite spectacularly. As a manager, having a dissenter in the room should be part of your management checklist. I seem to recall something called a devil's advocate.
Yeah, and it's deeper than that. It's creative and preventive dissent that has to get incorporated into policy decisions. And I hope people in the state government here, the federal government, and all the corporations in Alaska are listening to that last email you just got, because that guy, Adam, is right on the head with this one. If you don't have these alternative perspectives, you're liable to go into groupthink and make illogical, they may seem rational and logical at the time, but inaccurate decisions that get you into trouble, and that often happens.
That is Rick Steiner. We also have Richard Lefevre of Crossroads Leadership Institute. And Dick, I want to ask you this. The very word leadership shows up here in the name of your consulting company, and doesn't leadership constitute having a vision and then enlisting people to come along? I mean, isn't there, in a sense, isn't that not consonant with this idea of being able to head up a group of people that disagree?
Not always. It's unfortunate that a lot of leaders are put in positions where they don't have that skill set, or specifically that attribute of collaboration, of building a workforce, or having people in an organization that really can say the king has no clothes, sort of thing.
It could happen to just about anybody, no matter how strong their vision.
Well, in what way? What you mean?
Yeah, that you could not be wearing any clothes and not realize it.
Right. Well, one of the things, in looking at this idea of performance management, you know, this annual evaluation, you know, it's always done at the end of the year and looking back and, you know, what did you do in January? I'm giving you feedback now in December. I mean, that whole model is really bogus. Yeah. And if you take a look at effective performance feedback, team feedback, you really have to be open for the dissenters. And it can't be just a willy-nilly kind of thing. You know, you and I had a disagreement, Steve, back in January. I've been harboring that ever since. Now I'm going to nail you kind of thing. There has to be ways within that organization that you can create a safe space for dialogue, for raising issues. We're big advocates of 360 feedback, but not just, we talk about not just the form. You know, the manager gets feedback from 8 or 10 people, but you actually, as coach, to sit down with those people, and they look at specific behaviors that's creating, say, on a Likert scale, why I'm scoring low on these. And it is a very, very difficult thing to get people into honest conversations about those things. They're fearful.
Well, yeah, I think also one of the things about team is that teams mean you're throwing your whole self into it. You're doing more than your job description requires, in a sense, in the sense that you want the investment of the whole person, including the stuff you didn't think about when you wrote the job description.
Yeah.
That's what you need. And a person, especially today, I mean, it seems like the boomer generation, really, they were the most idealistic we're likely to have in a while. And they, you know, you guys are pretty much in that generation of throwing the just willing to really commit themselves and throw themselves, and a lot of them got burned.
Well, that's traditional. People, you know, the dissenter and the quote-unquote maverick traditionally gets vilified, marginalized, ostracized, and penalized for being outside of the group until there's one or two more joining them in their dissent. And then there's this strange psychology that accepts their dissent as mainstream. But there is this
great point.
There is a zealous protection of status quo going on, and that is what's going to kill civil society, if anything will. And we know status quo isn't working socially, economically, or environmentally, so it needs to change dramatically. And if we
that's the same hump. You're talking about the same hump in that's been studied in psychology that Dick is talking about trying to foster in his consulting work. And you know, he's telling us that it can be very frustrating to get management to accept that this really has to mean something.
It does. And, you know, there's some attempts. For instance, the State Department set up something called the Dissent Channel, where people could raise dissenting opinions on a 1-800 number or a phone line or something about foreign policy to try to correct it. But of the several hundred dissenting opinions that were called into that, not one resulted in a change in foreign policy. So you can set up a false venue for raising dissent. I've talked with a number of colleagues, Cook and Keeper and others here in Alaska, public employees for environmental responsibility, about trying to form a whistleblower dissent facility here in Alaska where agency personnel and industry representatives could feel comfortable coming forward with information that would help improve industrial behavior and government behavior. So we'll see about that. But there are ways to institutionalize
this. Well, weren't you involved in one with, maybe it was Ricky Ott, with Dan Lawn and what's-his-face, the pipeline guy?
Hamill.
Chuck Hamill.
Oh, yeah. I've been involved with Chuck ever since the mid-1980s.
Well,
and
yeah. I mean, there's certain
he's
people
a classic
inside,
whistleblower, certainly.
Right. There's
there's
certain people inside that he protects
and
fronts up to try and get something done.
And then Alyeska tried to institutionalize that with some people in a facility where people could bring forward, but it didn't really work. But I'm very glad that they've hired this new president who may bring in a fresh – it's the first time they've hired somebody from outside of the oil industry to be their lead. So.
Yeah, I've actually had a person who was in charge of that whistleblower program come into my APU classes on, I think, at least five different classes. And of course, recently we were hearing more that maybe it's not working. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of courage to stand up in an organization, even where there's purported to be protections, because you become ostracized, you become isolated, marginalized, as Rick was saying. This whole coalescing around a group, not just groupthink, but belonging, going back to your chimpanzee, this ape in the trees, I like that. But it's still here. It's like the primal brain is still working, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is known, you know, biologically.
Oh, yeah. And even you look at the Western culture model versus the tribal model, it's
more diffuse decision-making.
Basically, there's a number of reasons why people feel more loyalty to the tribe than they would to the society.
But again, there's need for both.
Yeah.
And I think to sustain a tribal group or a group of business or government agency people or whatever, you need consensus and conformity. But to progress that group, you need dissent, and you need innovation and creativity, and you need to stimulate that and foster it and provide
so
a safe
funny,
way to do that.
You also say if you have just one sorehead, it doesn't work so well. If you have a sorehead that's got a couple other people supporting them, then it starts to get somewhere.
That's the critical threshold, it seems to be.
Well, I want to put a plug in here. We were talking about the university here a little bit ago. I went to the grand opening or the reopening, I guess, relocation of the Cooperative Extension Service had the opening last night in their new facility, and Brian Rogers from UAF was down and did the ribbon cutting, but Bill Hall works there. I'm going to put a plug in for Bill. Bill has been doing a lot of work, not just with CES, but with the Kettering Foundation. I've been involved with him tangentially, actually training people in this whole idea of dialogue and deliberation. There are protocols, there are strategies, there are tools and techniques where we can bring around some very pressing public issue, public policy kinds of issues, whether it's resource development here in the state or, legislation around gay, lesbian ordinances, whatever, that we can have reasonable conversations. One of the problems I see is it's so easy to become vilified, marginalized because of the technology we have today.
Yeah.
Whether it's bloggers on the left, right, in the middle, or the 24/7 news, whatever it may be, if you have a particular view, and research has shown this as well, we will stick with that information that confirms our own view at that moment.
Yeah.
And we'll stick with it. So how to break out of that mold is a real challenge for us. I agree with Rick about, the challenge that's in front of us in terms of the global breakdown of our institutions, society. I mean, we need these kinds of technologies, these kinds of processes to really help us through this.
Well, I have to say, when you look at the Muckraker Awards, Ray Metcalf was helped by the internet, I think. I think probably Ricky Ott, certainly Jeannie Devon. I mean, she only really exists on the internet. Yeah. I mean, that's her main.
She's a real person, by the way.
I met her. Yeah.
A wonderful person.
Well, for a while, we weren't sure.
But you're right. I mean, the new social media and internet has created an enormous venue for.
So it's cutting both ways. But, what Dick says is I've certainly observed and wondered how to get a good grasp on that in a show about how it does that exact thing you're saying, because we all are biased to just accept the stuff that is.
One of the groups I'm working with, Steve, I'll put a plug in here again, is with the University of Arizona, and it's a UDAL Center, the Center for Environmental Conflict Resolution. And I'm working with a group called the Native Network, and we're actually putting together what's called a Wisdom Council. And these are Native elders who have wisdom, if you will, traditional knowledge and wisdom around how to resolve conflicts. And, it's become a real challenge as to who's going to be on this committee, on this group, and who determines who has wisdom. And so we're finding, as we go through this process, it's, another challenge, another piece of the unfoldment, if you will. It's really amazing. I mean, you have, even within the Native community, well, he's not wise. Or she's not wise.
That's to some extent human nature.
Yeah, human nature, right. But it's really interesting to see. But it's moving forward. That's the exciting part about it.
Yeah.
And you think about issues like Pebble Mine here in Alaska. I mean, how do we really get our arms around understanding which way to go here?
Right.
I mean, you have people and own families separated down the middle of the table, pro and con on this. Really?
And what are the ways? All kinds of money being spent
to
spin any conceivable thing to either pro or anti Pebble. I mean, it's just disgraceful.
One of the ways to institutionalize this sort of thing and incorporate dissenting opinion into policies and government process and such like that is, putting in another plug here, is the Regional Citizens Advisory Councils.
Yeah.
And particularly the one in Prince William Sound has been remarkably successful at engaging a very diverse group of stakeholders in providing oversight of Alyeska and the tankers.
And of course, Rick Steiner, you're being modest because that was your idea to start with.
Well, yeah, but it took a lot of people to make it happen. But here's where we go with this. We have proposed the same sort of thing in the Arctic. And I just met with one of the major oil companies last week about this, and they opposed the notion.
Mm.
And that shows me that they're still stuck in the last century, where they don't really truly feel comfortable with dissenting different perspectives. And right. I think it's short-sighted of them.
I've been hesitating to put out the phone number. It's 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk at APRN.org. I've got email waiting. I got calls waiting. Pam in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thank you. I would like to suggest that perhaps dissent is too late in the process. And based on my experience as an anthropologist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and most recently as a tribal liaison with a military organization, I think what could be done beforehand is to work on the theory of multiple hypotheses, have multiple people with different backgrounds to put in ideas, make sure that those inside agitators, if you want to think of it, are there. But when you go to the issue of having to have dissenters, they're very easily isolated and picked on, and actually, I mean, you can even have illegal and unethical aspects mm-hmm. of an organization when it comes down to having to have a paid dissenter.
If I could on that, I think that's an interesting perspective. And when we're saying dissent, I think we're trying to incorporate those early uses of it in a decision-making process. And I'd also say today, November 30th, is the 11th anniversary of one of the greatest, most successful citizen protests ever done, and that was the WTO protest in Seattle, was November 30th, 1999. That was too late in the process, in a way, to really affect WTO and their globalization, their free trade agenda and such. However, it was successful at interrupting that meeting, and it really brought the citizen dissent to the forefront in the entire discussion of globalization and the race to the bottom in environmental, social, and labor standards. So and no matter where it comes in it needs to come in.
In terms of protesting, it started a whole new model for how to be more effective and strategic and use the internet. Flash mobs and all that sort of thing has become customary. This is putting me in mind, Rick Steiner, of what you said in your little piece for Pacific Fishing. You said, as the powerful seek to silence truth and dissent only become more powerful.
Well, that's been the history of it. I mean, you look at the civil rights movement, you look at Gandhi, you look at Thoreau and Emerson, you look at Rachel Carson. There's a great example. You know, in 1962, when she wrote Silent Spring, she was ostracized and vilified, but what became more powerful was her ideas, and then subsequently, decades later, the substances, the persistent organic pollutants she was complaining about, are now banned.
So I think what you're saying, yeah, and you know, people are still, I still hear from people say, that gave DDT a bad reputation, DDT is still a good thing. I still get people saying
sure.
that. But the thing is, I think most people accept when Rachel Carson really had something to say, but it was so early, nobody could figure it out. So I guess, Dick LaFever, what I would ask you is, are we looking for the kind of manager that can recognize evolutionary thinking early?
Well, that's a yes. I hope so. And that brings to mind this idea of recruitment. I mean, when we start looking for those at the top of the organization, if it's a board or a government agency or whomever, what kind of person do we want to be there? If it's a crony, if it's an inside job, if it's, you know, that kind of cycle, then you're not going to have that paradigm change. You're not going to, if you want just the status quo, then fine. But if you're really trying to reinvent yourself or taking a look at how do we survive in this culture and this dynamic world that we live in, you have to look at those people who are that contain a little bit of dissent within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are those people that come into an organization and shake it up? Not just to shake it up, not just to, you know, rearrange the chairs on the Titanic, but actually chart a new course. You know, what are those attributes? They really have to be open for that. They have to have that background. You have to talk with them. You have to look inside their heart as well as their mind and see what they bring to that leadership position. And a board or executive body or have to be comfortable with that, whether it's a governor electing or selecting commissioners, a board selecting a CEO, or even someone in middle management. I think we have to err on the side of discaution, not going with the status quo right now in today's world. Rick talked about the financial sector. Part of, I think, underlying a lot of what's happening in our country today, if not the world, is this notion of capitalism, and it has to maintain what it always has been. I think it has to change. I think the model of capitalism needs to be worked. The idea.
Well, I think that's what the NGOs that Rick was talking about are about.
Well, yep. It's yep. One of the things, certainly. I mean, there was a quote from actually an Exxon executive at one point saying that, you know, those that favor, that thought capital, that socialism was the answer, didn't tell the economic truth, and capitalism really doesn't tell the environmental truth, the ecological truth. No. And so we've got some sort of a blending of the two economic models that we need to look forward to in the future. And that's what we're sort of doing.
Yeah, a number of years ago, this has been maybe 15 years ago or more, I've been a member of the Resource Development Council for many years, and they actually had a program on. And it said, if you want to save the environment, hire the developer. And if you want to develop, hire the environmentalist. and it was almost like cognitive dissonance gone amok at this meeting.
But that's a good point.
And they hired the two people. They were out of Montana, interestingly mm-hmm. enough. One a think tank in Bozeman, and the other one from Montana State University. And the discussion was one of the most enlightening wow. and invigorating discussions that I've seen at RDC.
Dick Lefevre of Crossroads Leadership Institute. Dick was also, I think, the founder of the Socrates Cafe.
yeah.
Maybe we can revive that one as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a fuel-free energy alternative to South Central Alaska natural gas. Learn more at fireislandwind.com.
Yes, it is Talk of Alaska. This quote came in from someone who, just anonymous, but they're quoting George Bernard Shaw, so, you know, we get a chuckle out of it for sure. The reasonable man adapts himself to the conditions that surround him. The unreasonable man adapts surrounding conditions to himself. All progress depends on the unreasonable man.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear. And that is the way society and ecosystems and biology progress and evolve.
Wow.
Well, I love that George Bernard Shaw. My wife and I spent a month in Ireland last year, and so we got a lot of Shaw over there, and people love him there, too. I mean, he's great.
yes, and definitely a socialist.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go to Caroline in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Caroline.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Steve, you are a member of what I consider a chosen profession. The words we choose, and I don't mean you specifically, but overall, it's hallowed what you do, and I thank you for the subjects you bring up. But the words we choose define how we feel many times, and the idea of muckraker, if you flip that over and called it a problem solver, I think it would be much better. I was going to mention.
No, I think what my thinking was, there's no muck to rake. If there's no muck to rake, a muckraker's out of business. The problem is, how do we stop making the muck?
But she's right. It is problem solving, Caroline. Yeah. You're absolutely correct.
Well, the thing I heard an elder say one time, a native elder, was the fish rots from the head, and as long as we don't have a diversity at the head, we're going to have a problem. But Adam mentioned in his email many of the things I was going to say. The three women that blew the whistle at the FBI, Enron, and I can't remember the other one, that made the Time magazine cover of the year that year, they had more, I think, females have more of a long-term thinking. Minorities have a view of what they have seen from the outside because they have not had the opportunity to be in a decision-making place. My sadness is the civil rights movement is a prime example of organizations that when certain people or any people get to the top, they exclude other views. I remember a program that used to be funded by the corporation I worked for called the Problem Solving Bowl. Hmm. And one year, the winners in 1985, the winners were kids from Gamble. And they won the state, the national, and the international problem-solving bowl. And the international topic, this was out in Seattle, was genetic engineering. And they had the model, though, of a people who needed everyone's input in order to live. And much like Fairbanks back in the 50s with a woman mayor, another woman mayor in the 80s, and a black mayor in the 90s, which unfortunately that didn't work out all that well. And I knew Jim Hayes, and I was sad when he and his wife went to federal prison for their misbehavior. But the openness of a society under stress, I think, is understandable. When we become complacent, then we become hierarchical. And whether it's a male or a female or a minority or not, when they get in that 1.5% top echelon of decision makers, they wouldn't get there if they didn't agree with the established position.
That is often, Caroline, that's often the case, is people who are status quo conformists do get promoted within a system, and then those people you're speaking of can become victims of the very thing they started out opposing. So it is it's a work in progress. You can't just say, well, I'm a nonconformist and a dissenter, and this is the way I am. You have to wake up every morning and do that.
Wow, we didn't even get to.
You have to be willing to say, as you said at the beginning of the program, you have to be willing to say, I don't know everything.
That's right.
Yeah that's a dangerous thing, because we expect leaders to know everything, and we've got to get over that.
Mm-hmm. We didn't even get to the WikiLeaks, which I figured some caller would bring up, and nobody did, and looks like we're not gonna, because Jack says, hey, Rick, I heard you mention Paul Hawken. Are you familiar with the Long Now Foundation?
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with the Clock of the Long Now and the Long Now Foundation that Paul has set up or is involved with. But the Clock of the Long Now is basically a clock that will chime every 1,000 years. It's a very low energy construction. And the idea is to give us this, it will do this for 10,000 years, to give us this concept that we are thinking way, way into the future. And things we do today are either foreclosing a sustainable, progressive future or enabling that. And that's why the decisions we make now are utterly important.
Dick LaFever, I want to ask you for a reaction to this transition communities thing, if you've heard about that yet.
Well, transition community, I know, are you talking about like sustainable communities?
We have one in Anchorage now, transition communities. It was just a group of people, and they say, we're just going to grab hold of it and do it.
I'm not familiar with those people.
Okay.
Steve, I used to think of Spinard as a transition community.
We are.
It's where you live.
Oh, okay.
No, but it was the idea that, you know, trying to push institutions can be counterproductive, and maybe you need to do like Rick was saying, like the and some NGOs are doing. You just basically go ahead with your priorities and let institutional wisdom catch up with it.
Well, I like that.
Yeah,
because I think that grassroots kind of thing really has the power. I mean, you can almost see that a little bit with the Tea Party. You know, it may not be the entire package that we're all happy with. For sure.
But and Helen, we'll close with a quote from Helen Keller, and that is, I rejoice to live in such a splendidly disturbing time, and we need to rejoice and make it better.
Congratulations, Muckraker of the Year. Rick Steiner, thanks. Dick LaFever, thank you also to Pat Yak, BD Trantina, Dave Waldron. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Pin Air, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com. And by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.